Hey, Ryan Reynolds here. Wishing you a very happy half-off holiday because right now, Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. And Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So, that means a half day, yeah?
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Joey Dunlop, born dirt poor, with no running water, no electric. He was the definition of the everyman hero in earning the title the King of the Roads in what must be considered one of the world's most extreme sports, motorcycle road racing. Dunlop won the hearts and minds of millions during his 31 career, culminating in his greatest triumph in the year 2000 at the Isle of Man. However, tragedy was never far away. It is the subject of a brilliant new book called Joey Dunlop, the definitive biography. It's by Stuart Barker. Delighted to be joining me live on the line today, Stuart Barker. Stuart, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Charles. Very nice to join you.
Good to have you with us. Now then, for those who don't know, the sport, we may know MotoGP, we may know the superbikes, but road racing is an entirely different beast.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't be more correct. Road racing, it takes place, as the name suggests, on everyday public roads. I mean, they're obviously closed to traffic. But rather than billiard table smooth MotoGP tracks or superbike tracks, you know, you're running, you've got jumping over humpback bridges, over tram lines, you've got drain covers, you've got curbs, you've got white lines and cat's eyes and walls and trees and houses and lampposts. I mean, every kind of hazard you could imagine. And these guys are doing over 200 miles an hour in a mass pack. So, I mean, the TT, they're on their own against the clock, but at places like the Ulster Grand Prix and the Northwest 200, you're in a mass pack. So it is just one of the most spectacular things to witness if you haven't been. And as you say, it's very different to MotoGP and Superbike. It's got less of the kind of glamour. It's got less of the money. So the people that do it purely for the love of it. And I think that's why people are so kind of passionate about it.
And also, of course, you're closer to the fans. The bikes are recognisable as something that you and I could pick up from a showroom or a second-hand thing and take on the road. And perhaps it's that immediacy that the riders are very much almost like one of us that makes it such a, if you like, a cult sport, perhaps in mainland Britain, but in Northern Ireland, and Ireland in particular, has produced generation upon generation of brilliant road racing stars.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. Northern Ireland and Ireland in general is the home of it, and obviously the Isle of Man. And probably because they don't have so many purpose-built short circuits, they've used the natural roads as a way to go racing. And of course, in the old days, you used to have to race both. In the World Championships, when they started in 1949, your Mike Hailwoods and your Joachim Agostinis and your Jeff Jukes and John Surtees, they had to race on both purpose-built short circuits and the real roads events. But it's become more of a specialist thing since the 70s when the TT was dropped from the Grand Prix World Championship calendar for just being too dangerous. And then it became a sort of more specialist sport, which it arguably remains to this day, although there's a bit more crossover now from British superbikes. Some of those guys have decided to have a go at the TT, Peter Hickman and Josh Brooks and people like that. So, but what you say about the bikes is correct. I mean, riders, fans are riding up to watch the races on pretty much the same bikes as the guys who are racing them. Sure, they're tuned and they are better bikes all round, but they're based on road models, and I think that does give a connection with the fans.
You mentioned some of the names there: Jeff Duke, Mike the Bike, Hailwood, etc. Joey Dunlop was something else, something completely different. He didn't really come from a racing background. He came from, put it mildly, a pretty impoverished one.
Yeah, they were very poor. I mean, no electricity, no running water, and trying to squeeze sort of a family of nine into a little three-bedroom cottage was never easy. And I mean, they didn't even have a television until Joey was in his teens. So to have come from nothing to get to where he got to, but essentially his character never changed in the slightest, and that's why people loved him, because he turned down five-star hotels. He turned down he didn't even return Honda's contracts. He didn't feel he should be paid for what he was doing. He considered it a great honour that they were allowing him to ride his bikes. So Honda tried to pay him on many occasions, and he didn't sign or return the contract. So he could have been far, far, far more wealthy than he was. But his humility and his dislike of expecting anything from anyone else just kind of prevented him from doing that. He was the most humble person that I've ever been aware of.
And you'd expect, you know, the open road motorcycle races taking incredible risks, as we said before, thundering through Douglas, you know, at breakneck speed, taking off over the bridge. You'd expect them to be these sort of almost like these crosses between Schwarzenegger and The Rock, wouldn't you? But Joey was a wiry, a wee man, as the saying goes.
Yeah, I mean, it still amazes me when you see motorcycle racers being interviewed and they've got librarians' glasses on and they're nutritionally obsessed. they're so clean, and you think, how can you actually do what you do? But Joey was, particularly in the 70s, the long sort of greasy hair. He was always covered black with oil and grease and just a pair of old overalls. And as you say, very wiry. And he remained that way. I mean, racers, it is an advantage to be small and light. Joey just naturally was. He certainly didn't follow any nutritional advice, or he never went to the gym. He was far too fond of his vodka and cokes and cigarettes. But the talent was in his right wrist and in his brain and in his experience and his racecraft and his courage. And it seems that in Joey's case, and they did take him to Queen's University Belfast in his 40s. And concluded that it was a natural phenomenon. His physical endurance was a natural phenomenon rather than earned down the gym. And he was posting results that, you know, a sort of 30-year-old would have been proud of. So he just did have a natural knack for... the stamina required when you're racing in the humidity and heat of places like Portugal and Japan, and riders having to be put on IV drips after the race, you know, to replace the fluids, and jumping into paddling pools filled with ice and still not being able to lower the core temperature. I mean, many riders have been vomited in their helmets mid-race because of the dehydration and the humidity. And yet Joey could just kind of soak it all up naturally. He was quite a phenomenon.
So when did the talent begin to show itself, and what were the early races?
Yeah, it was quite a slow burner, to be fair. He raced largely due to just lack of budget. So he raced absolute rubbish bikes for the first few years, and it was a few years before he started getting top six results. And then when he did get a bit of sponsorship at first from a chap called John Ray, who is grandfather of World Superbike champion Jonathan Ray, that's what really kind of made the difference. He suddenly had a bike under him and a bit of financial help behind him, and then there was no going back. When he won the Jubilee TT in 1977, That was the real turning point, and he was then on everybody's radar because the even at that point, with some sponsorship, his bike was still the scruffiest bike on the grid, and everybody looked at it laughing, thinking it was never going to finish the race. And then it not only finished it, it beat the rest of them, beat them all.
And the appeal of this is the immediacy, isn't it? Is the fact that they're, you know, the fans don't, you know, they get to see their heroes, get to mingle with their heroes. They don't, you know, yeah, they don't sit behind, you know, paddocks and million-dollar motorhomes.
Yeah, for starters, you don't need a ticket. You know, the TT is free, as are most road races. There are no grandstands. The hedges and the bankings are your grandstands, and you can literally sit with your feet. I mean, not so much now; it's got tightened up a bit. But when I was going to watch Joey when I was younger, with your feet over the hedge, over the banking, on the road itself, so they were literally coming past you, but 2 feet away at 180 miles an hour. And it's terrifying and exhilarating at the same time to watch. The first time they can pass, you take in the biggest sharp intake of breath. It literally takes your breath away. No matter how many times I stand at the bottom of Bray Hill at the Isle of Man TT, the first time you've seen them for a year, it literally sucks the breath out of you. It's that spectacular.
And I mean,
and by contrast, sorry, but you know, I've not long returned from watching a race at Silverstone, which is all well and nice, but sat up in a grandstand so far from the riders, I couldn't actually see who was who, and there's chicken wire fences, and I understand the need for safety, and that's what kind of leads to, you know, the endless debate about road racing. Should it be banned? Should it be banned because it's more dangerous? But yes, it is. There's no getting away from that, but there's nobody holding a gun to their heads making them do it. And I don't believe that one adult has the right to tell another adult what he should do, really.
And this is the thing, isn't it? Because if you ban road racing, because to a majority of people now, in any formula, if you want to go car racing, unless you start being clubman, you need an awful lot of money to do it. If you want to go bike racing, you need, you know, if you go through the categories, you know, even getting involved in national at a major is extremely expensive. The appeal is the fact that, you know, poor kids from Northern Ireland, or, you know, who are mechanics, who make their own bikes, can go out and go on what is arguably, you know, one of the biggest circuits. I mean, it's not just a TT as well. You talked about Japan and Portugal. There is a road racing circuit, you know, throughout the world.
Yeah, it's very much more accessible to riders, although I would argue it's becoming less that way, because even at grassroots level now, the sport is hideously expensive. I have a friend who does some club racing around here, and it's just incredible. Every penny he earns from work, he pours into that, and that's at the, you know, that's at rookie level and the lowest sort of club championship you can. So there's no such thing as a cheap way to go racing, but it's certainly far less expensive than British superbikes, world superbikes, or MotoGP. Yeah.
And talking about you know, the corporate and it's very refined. You know, I've got a motor racing background. You know, we go to the Grand Prix and it's very corporate these days. Isle of Man Week is very much not like that, is it? I mean, especially back in the 80s when Joe was starting to dominate the sport.
Yeah, I mean, that's another huge part of the appeal for it, and that's why some people think Joey just fitted in better with road racing. I mean, he was a good short circuit racer earlier in his career, but all the sort of corporate sponsorship and the pressures and the sunglasses and the hair gel, that was just never going to sit with Joey. So he preferred nothing better than rocking up at an Irish road race, working out the back of a van on the wet grass with a bike on its side, and, you know, borrowing parts off other riders and helping other riders. And there's a real camaraderie to road racing. Everyone, I think also because of the levels of danger, Giles, the riders respect each other that bit more and just help each other in any way they can. So it's as far removed from the Formula One sort of scene as you could get when it comes to that.
And also there's that sort of stripped down approach, talking about working out the back of a van. To get your bike from Ireland or from mainland Britain to the Isle of Man for the TT, you know, normally you take a ferry, some might even possibly fly. Joey did things a little bit differently once in a very small boat with interesting results.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't once. When he first went to the Isle of Man TT, he went over in a friend's converted fishing boat and won the race, so that it became a good luck sort of token for him. But in 1985, it all went wrong when they missed the tide, and it was about midnight, so it was pitch dark, and the boat struck the rocks coming out of Stranford Loch into the Irish Sea. There's some really dangerous reefs and rocks there when the tide's a bit low. And, you know, once again, away from the world of racing, Joey proved to be a hero all over again, because there was about four people on the boat that couldn't swim. So he made sure he threw jerry cans over the side for them to use as sort of life preservers. He jumped over the side himself, got a penknife out, and cut the rope to the dinghy, the life raft. And I tracked down the actual lifeboat crews that rescued him that night. And to a man, they all said it was incredible. He just never, he didn't panic. He wasn't in a flap. He was just as calm and cool as he was walking through the paddock. And yet his life, all of the lives were very, very much at risk. There was 12 people on board. And of course, the TT had started that day, so all Joey was concerned about was getting to the TT. A lot of the bikes went down. Fortunately, Joey's were already on the Isle of Man, courtesy of Honda. But they dived to salvage for the bikes the next day. Joey took a flight to the Isle of Man, a bit more sensible the next day, even though he hated flying in the early days as well. I spoke to a photographer called Don Morley, who had to hold Joey's hand throughout a flight. So if you think these guys who ride at 200 miles an hour between brick walls are fearless, they're not. They just managed to sort of contain that fear and compartmentalize that fear. Joey was terrified of flying, and yet he thought nothing of racing down Bray Hill at 200 miles an hour. It's crazy.
It's funny, isn't it? And there was, if you like, a bit of, you know, it was Beatlemania. I mean, not since sort of Barry Sheen, you know, for the English, had been racing, had we seen such a swell of support. Okay, maybe Mike the Bike as well, when he came back to the Isle of Man in 79 to win his titles. But, you know, Joey became pretty much a household name. And then, you know, 12 years later, or 11 years later, he comes back. Tell us about the 2000 Isle of Man and why that is legendary to anybody who's got an interest in any form of motorsport.
Yeah, well, in 1989, a bit of a watershed in Joey's career. He had a really bad crash at Brands Hatch, ironically a safe circuit. And it took him years to get back to full fitness again, and he stopped racing in short circuits, and he was forced to ride little 125cc machines because he didn't have the strength for the big superbikes. And, you know, he was almost being lapped at races, and he thought people were laughing at him. And slowly but surely, he worked his way back to full fitness. He got onto slightly bigger bikes, and he won lots more races, lots more TTs, but he couldn't win on the big superbike. That was just seemed beyond him. And at the age of 48 years old, you know, bespectacled, fully grey hair, his chances were completely written off, basically, against a new generation of riders like David Jeffries and Michael Rutter and John McGuinness. I mean, super fast, younger guys, much fitter. And Joey destroyed them in 2000, and not only won the TT Formula One race, which he hadn't won for 12 years since the 1980s, he won the 125 and 250 as well. So he did a treble in his very final year at the TT, which, you know, anyone who's seen that, I spoke to Michael Rutter, who finished on the podium with him that week, saying he's just never seen anyone ride a motorcycle like that in his life. You know, the back wheel was a foot off the ground under braking. And he was riding it like Brands Hatch, like Silverstone, like a short circuit. But these are bumpy country roads, much, much faster roads than those little tight circuits. And you could still hear the awe in Michael Rutter's voice when he was remembering it. He had never seen a man ride a motorcycle like that before.
When in 2000, when the Iron Curtain came down, suddenly road racing had become popular throughout a lot of the former Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc countries. And Joey couldn't resist the chance to go over and race over there.
Yeah, because it was very much like road racing back home in Ireland in the 70s. You know, it was out the back of a van, there's nobody had loads of money, there wasn't anybody posing about with paddock passes and sunglasses. It was just real grassroots racing again. And he loved the trips, he loved the long journeys to visit historical sites all throughout Europe, had a weekend's racing, had a good night round the campfire with a bottle of vodka and headed home again. And I could see the attraction for knowing the kind of person he was. You can see why he would far rather do that. Even though there was no money in it, there was no media attention in it, you know, he appreciated that all the more. That was just him. That's how he liked to go racing at the beginning, and that's how he liked to go racing at the end.
And of course, you know, 2000, he comes back, he makes that brilliant Isle of Man win in the three classes. And yet, a matter of weeks later, he's killed in a racing accident.
Yeah, it really was. Only about 2 weeks later, and he'd gone out to Tallinn, Estonia, and he had won the 600 race and the superbike race, and then he'd gone out on the 125, and the heavens opened on one particular part of the track. It was very localized. Downpour, and Joey with an intermediate tire on the rear just hit standing water that, you know, no matter how much skill he had, the bike just aquaplaned. There was nothing and no one that could have done anything about it. And obviously you have people saying, well, he raced till he was 48, should have retired, and, you know, it was always going to happen. It was inevitable if he kept doing it. But I just don't think he knew what else he would do with his life. Racing was his life. So again, who are we to sort of say he should have stopped or he shouldn't have. He did what he wanted to do, and tragedy. I mean, no one could believe it because he had been so safe. He was never a crasher. He learned to ride in those dangerous roads. You had to be really smooth. You had to leave safety margins. He knew exactly what he was doing. The last person, I mean, we don't expect anyone to get killed, but the last person we expected was Joey, because he'd just been so safe for so long, and he knew when not to push his luck. He was, you know, he was 48. He wasn't out to win every race. He just did it because he loved it. And if something wasn't feeling right, he'd have backed off, no problem. So he wasn't reckless. He wasn't dangerous. He was by far the most experienced guy on the grid. But it just does underline the point that road racing is dangerous and it can happen to anybody.
And I mean, you talk about the reverberation through the sport, because a lot of people of the older generation will know when in motor racing Jim Clark was killed, or perhaps in my generation when Senna was killed. The shock went through, and I'm, you know, a motor racing fan, so I knew of Johnny Dunlop, but he was seemed to be invincible. And again, it was pre-social media. It was on the news that on the national news that Dunlop had been killed, and it was that intake of breath, because you didn't think you know he was, as you said, he kept within the limits, you know, and he seemed to be he wasn't a crasher, and so, and that outpouring of emotion was evident, obviously, in his funeral, with what was it, over 60,000 people turning up.
Yeah, I mean, nobody, the family were expecting maybe 3,000 people, and the police thought the same. So when they pulled open the curtains to see more than 60,000 people, I mean, it was, I think the only funeral in the UK that's been bigger was Princess Diana. But this is this isn't royalty. Well, he's racing royalty, but this is a little guy who built bikes in his shed and never ever courted media attention and hated cameras in his face. And he did everything he could not to be famous, and yet he couldn't help but just touch people. And if you ever needed proof of how loved he was, the funeral was it. 60,000 people. It was broadcast live on Irish television. It stunned everyone who was there. I mean, there were famous boxers, Barry McGuigan, David Coulthard, Formula One stars and sports stars, and ministers from London and the Isle of Man and Dublin and Belfast. I mean, it was just an extraordinary tribute that once and for all showed how loved he was.
And again, you mentioned,
and still is.
You mentioned McGuigan, but he was truly an Irish sports hero who crossed over. You know, he was a sports hero. That's the first thing about him. There wasn't any political, there wasn't any religious. He was just Joey Dunlop.
Yeah, I mean, no matter what side of the divide you were on, everybody loved Joey. He could race just as freely in the south of Ireland as the north, and fans travelled back and forward, and there was never any trouble at bike races. That's one thing that did unite everyone. But interesting you say that about Brian McGuigan, because the Belfast Telegraph ran a poll a few years ago, and Joey Dunlop was voted Northern Ireland's greatest ever sportsman, and that's ahead of Rory McIlroy and George Best, Barry McGuigan, just Alex Higgins, just incredible how much he touched the mainstream, as you say, as well as just diehard race fans.
It's been seems strange to say 21 years since we lost Joey, which is quite something, because again, as always, it seems like just yesterday. What was it like for you to put together this book, and who did you speak to, and what were the memories that came back?
Well, I had over the years, I've been a motorcycle journalist for the last 25 years or so, and I spoke to so many people who had Joey stories. It seemed no matter who you spoke to, they all had little funny Joey stories, and I just thought that wouldn't it be great to just sort of bring all these together. So teammates, mechanics, photographers, team bosses, sponsors, rivals, they all had stories to tell, and it was a genuine pleasure. I mean, I've never written a book where I've laughed and shed a tear sort of on the same day. It was strange because there was so many funny stories that I was genuinely rocking with laughter in one phone call. And then when I spoke to John Harris, who was with Joey in Estonia when he was killed, then obviously, you're no longer laughing. It was very difficult to write the sort of final chapter. Because as a huge fan myself, since I was 13 years old, I remember it all. I remember in great detail. As you say, it only seems like yesterday. But to hear it from those that were so close to Joey was just really, really heartbreaking as well. So I figured if it was causing such emotional effects in me writing the book, then hopefully it can maybe touch a few people as they read it as well.
Leave us then, if you would. I mean, I'll ask you where you should be in the pantheon of bike stars in a minute, but let's not leave them on a sad story, as the saying goes. I mean, there are so many evenings around the campfire with a bottle of vodka and a chaser of Coke or whatever. So, just one that sprang out for you.
It's
repeatable on the radio.
There were times when Joey and his little entourage, he always had a close-knit bunch of friends from back home with him at races. And Paul Iddon, who was one of Joey's rivals in the TT Formula One World Championship, he said that Joey's team would always try and get you drunk so that it would work against you, so that the next morning you had a hangover and they knew that Joey could handle a hangover no problem. So Paul had a few drinks with them, but got away to his bed about 2 o'clock in the morning. And when he came down, when he got up in the morning to go to the paddock to race, he said there was Joey's gang still there with only a bottle of Femme de Monde, because they'd drunk everything behind the bar. He said the curtains were torn off the windowsills, every chair and table was upended, and they're still sat drinking a bottle of green, what did I call it?
Creme de Menthe.
The Creme de Menthe. And Paul knew that they'd failed. That's what they were trying to do to him, to get him to stay with them so that he'd be too hungover to race Joey. But Joey could race with hangovers as well. He pulled out of the he pulled out the senior TT in 1992, claiming he had double vision, and that's kind of as far as it went. But Nick Jeffries, his teammate at one point, told me, yeah, he had double vision because he was out. He was out in the lash until about 4 o'clock in the morning. So, Joey didn't let racing get in the way of a good drink too much.
Absolutely brilliant. I mean, like I said, we have the greats of circuit racing. Agostini, you said, you know, you've got Barry Sheen, etc. And we're about to say goodbye to Valentino Rossi in his last season as well, the Doctor. You've got to put, haven't you, Joey, Jeff Duke, Joey, Mike Hellwood, pretty much on the same plinth in terms of of racing greats. And as a people's champion, Joey Dunlop beats them all.
Yeah, certainly as a people's champion, I would completely agree. Carl Fogarty said an interesting thing when I interviewed him for the book, and that was he hates being asked this question because eras are different, riders are different, the bikes are different, everything's different. But the one thing he said was, Joey is still the most successful TT rider of all time with 26 wins, and that's a fact, that's not an opinion. So he said, you know, that fact alone makes him one of the, if not the greatest TT rider of all time, certainly Rhodes rider.
And did Fogarty give you that stare when he was saying it?
No, it was difficult on the phone because we were in lockdown.
Well, that's pretty good move.
Although Foggy has such a piercing stare, it probably could have got through the phone line.
The book is called Joey Dunlop, The Definitive Biography. Stuart, if people want to find out more about it, where is it published? Where can people find information about it?
It's published by John Blake. It's out now as a hardback and a Kindle and an audiobook, and it's on Amazon or any other online retailer and in all good bookshops now that they're open again.
And it will also be available as a virtual download from our own TRE bookstore as well. The book is called Joey Dunlop, The Definitive Biography. It's by Stuart Barker. Stuart, as you can probably tell, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
You too, Giles. Thank you so much.